Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and discuss what amounts to a declaration of war today on South Sudan by the Northern Sudanese leader General Omar Bashir, himself a war criminal indicted by the International Criminal Court. Sondra Hale, who has been visiting, studying and working in Sudan for the past 50 years, joins us to discuss an impending outbreak of war against the world's newest country over contested oil fields the Chinese have developed. Then we'll look into the so-called war on women that has been fanned by an overblown spat between Hillary Rosen and Ann Romney over working mums versus stay-at-home mums. The president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research, Dr. Heidi Hartman, joins us to discuss the real issues obscured by this fatuous debate, which is that women are not paid equally for equal work. And given that 95% of women in America don't have rich husbands and work for a living, the Ann Romney flap is not a women's but a class issue. Then finally, we'll speak with Joe Hagan, who has an article at the Texas Monthly, Dan Rather was right about George W. Bush. We'll revisit the pivotal 60-minute story in the 2004 Bush-Kerry campaign that could have contrasted the war hero Kerry with a draft dodger who, because of family connections, received favorable treatment to enter the Air National Guard. Joe Hagan will answer the mysteries still surrounding the story that killed Dan Rather's career and helped re-elect George W. Bush. And joining us now is Sondra Hale, who is a professor of anthropology at UCLA. She's been studying and doing field work and living in Sudan for over 50 years. She's the author of numerous books and articles, including Locating Sudan Studies, Gender Politics in Sudan, and Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sondra Hale.
Thank you.
And the newest nation on the earth, South Sudan, is about to go to war, if we are to believe the Northern Sudanese President Omar Bashir, who today, addressing a rally at his party headquarters, said that his main goal is now to liberate the people of South Sudan from its rulers. That's tantamount to a declaration of war, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, but they've been making various statements for some time now that seem tantamount to a declaration of war. They've moved their troops down to various border areas, down and up, both sides, both South Sudan and Sudan, and have declared opposition parties who are soft on the occupation of Heleg, which is where the oil fields are, have declared them to be betraying traitors to the state and so on. So they've been using extremely strong language, both sides actually, but especially the North.
And of course, Bashir told the rally that the story began in Heleg, but it will end in Khartoum or Juba. What do you make of that?
Well, probably that might, I don't know about ending in Khartoum, but amassing troops and moving towards Juba is a possibility. But we have to remember that that successive governments controlled by the North were not able to defeat the Southern Sudan in all of these many decades. So I'm not too worried. I am worried about about the loss of lives and the waste that this will create. But I'm not necessarily worried that the North will be able to defeat the South. What I'm also concerned about is that the remnants of the Southern Sudan forces have united with some of the Darfur guerrilla elements, who have in turn then are talking about how they're going to march on Khartoum. And that would have made us laugh a few years ago, except that one of the guerrilla groups did invade Khartoum. I mean, they were wiped out. They took 3,000 military figures, soldiers, and actually tried to cause damage, tried to take over the Khartoum government. This has never happened before. But they were wiped out. But it's not beyond the realm of possibility.
But prior to this declaration of war, if you will, by the North Sudanese on the new country to the south, which used to be part of Sudan and was recently split and South Sudan recognized as an independent country, and you have the oil fields that are in the south that were developed largely by the Chinese, but the oil pipelines are in the north, and the particular oil field over which they've been fighting, the Heleg oil field, That's pretty much generally recognized as North Sudanese territory, isn't it?
Oh, it's borderline, and it's not. No, it definitely isn't, and it is the main oil field. But, you know, these borders are disputed, so both sides have claimed it.
I see. But
they haven't redrawn the boundaries, not that that will necessarily solve anything, but they haven't redrawn the boundaries, and so it really is, fallacious to talk in terms of whether or not Heleg belongs to the north or belongs to the south. It's very fluid and very complicated.
Well, but the fact remains that you have the oil's in the south, the pipelines are in the north, and at this point the south has cut off the flow of oil, which of course is cutting off the revenues for both North and South Sudan. I mean, clearly both sides have an interest in making some kind of a peace deal if their main source of revenue is oil. And I imagine the Chinese who have invested billions in developing these oil fields, they want peace.
Of course. And we've been saying, when I say we, I mean Sudanists and Sudanese have been saying for some time that this is just war talk because people have everything to lose. They have nothing to gain, really, from going to war again, because it'll be another intractable struggle. I can't think that it would be anything else. That is, unless something very strange happens, such as the Chinese infusing, either South Sudan, what would be South Sudan, with enormous amounts of weaponry, and some other power infusing the North with a lot of weaponry. That might change the balance of power or whatever. But right now, as things stand now, none of us can imagine that either side really wants to go to war. But they're playing a very dangerous game because they're getting closer and closer and closer. The North declared that the Southern Sudanese that decided to stay are really almost enemy aliens, and you know, just lots of very, very hostile acts have been going on, especially from the north towards the south, although the south has not exactly been innocent in this matter. They've been amassing their troops in these various border areas for some time and have made their own threats.
So Sandra Hale, again, professor of anthropology at UCLA. She's been studying and doing field work in and living in Sudan for over 50 years. And she's the author of Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide. Is there any possibility that the Chinese could build pipelines to the Indian Ocean, taking a southern route, as opposed to being dependent upon on the pipelines across the territories of North Sudan?
Well, the South claims to have set up some arrangements with Ethiopia and Kenya to be able to put pipelines through their countries in a cooperative way. But most of the experts have said that this might take 5 years. So the question is, you know, what's going to happen in the interim? If they could build those pipelines overnight, then some of the issue would be solved. Not for the north, of course, which would be without oil, but the problem for the South would be solved. They could reopen their oil fields and become a fairly productive country for a while, although it's estimated that those oil reserves in the South that everybody is fighting over are only going to last about 10 years. And unless the South manages to build up other ways of generating revenue, they're going to be in trouble, period.
But since the independence of South Sudan, the northern-controlled Sudan armed forces have been bombing the Nuba Mountains, and that has led people like George Clooney and John Pendergast and others have had, as you probably recall, they were arrested in front of the North Sudanese embassy in protest. Why is there this sort of endless desire on the part of the North to keep killing their own African population?
Well, they're all Africans.
Right, but the darker-skinned Africans, then.
They're all about the same color. But at any rate, we won't quibble about that.
What's the divide, Christian versus Muslim?
No, it's not that either, because in the Nuba Mountains, for example, we have Christians and Muslims in the same family. They're nominal Christians, nominal Muslims, and very, very mixed from one village to the other, and as I said, from one family to the other. So it's not really a Christian-Muslim conflict in this case.
But what is it then?
Well, there are resources in the Nuba Mountains, and the Nuba have always been, for many, many decades, have been a thorn in the side of any administration, starting with the colonial powers, with the British, and they've been resistant to every single government. It's really hard to know what's going to go on in the Nuba Mountains, but it is at the hottest spot now in Sudan. The government is carrying out horrible atrocities. The people who are trying to raise attention, whether they're celebrities or not, I think are doing a fairly positive thing. I mean, none of us like to see celebrities playing as if they are, political experts. But on the other hand, the Nuba Mountains is an area that, hardly anyone in the world knows anything about. And so it was a matter of attracting attention.
Well, I think a lot of people, of course, probably saw the television pictures of George Clooney getting handcuffed. And, you're telling them what the real issues are here, and that's very helpful. Sondra Hale, again, anthropologist at UCLA, expert on Sudan, where she's been studying, living, and doing field work for the last 50 years. Her new book is Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide. So the UN Security Council have been told that Sudan and South Sudan are locked in a logic of war by African Union mediator Thabo Mbeki and UN envoy Haley Menkarius. Do you think that there's any diplomatic solution here?
Well, eventually there might be, but I think they're going to be locked into the state for some time to come. On the, quote, brink of war, this could go on for a decade. And with, with each day, we might read the BBC and there may be another, act that looks like a declaration of war. On the other hand, I suppose there's a chance that armed hostilities could break out as we're speaking. But my guess is that won't happen, that there'll be these smaller skirmishes that will go on. There will be several kinds of diplomatic attempts. Most of them will fail because there hasn't been a really, even though in 2005 there was something signed called a comprehensive peace agreement between the North and the South, but it failed because Darfur was not in the mix. And this time I think that various diplomatic efforts could fail because the Nuba might not be in the mix, or Darfur. And so unless there is a more comprehensive series of peace agreements, I think that any of them are bound to fail, if not initially. And that is, we might be able to see a ceasefire for a while, but it will break down as it did before. There are so many things that haven't been dealt with. The racism of northern government towards its various outliers, its marginal areas, just to name one thing, which is pretty major. And then the constant fear that these marginal areas have that they are going to be taken over and forced to convert to whatever, not necessarily Islam, but forced to convert to the cultural and political hegemony of the central government. So I'm not very hopeful with regard to diplomatic attempts, but of course they have to try it. I mean, you can't not do anything. And as a Sudanist, it's very, very difficult for me to decide what kind of role I can play in this. And writing about it is about the only thing I can think of right now. I have been trying to help internally displaced persons, IDPs, in the capital. I've been to Sudan at least two times since I last talked with you. After the government attacked the Nuba Mountains in June of 2011, people either fled into the hills in South Kordofan, or they fled to the main towns. And so there are tens of thousands of refugees now, internal refugees, in the capital. So some of us, many of us, have been attempting to alleviate some of that pain and suffering as well. But that, you know, that was something. I was supposed to go to the Nuba Mountains, by the way, 4 days before. We didn't actually have a departure date, but we might have been in the Nuba Mountains, my research partner and I, when the government attacked. So I'm very involved, very committed to the Nuba cause, and I'm trying to help in any small way I can. And I can only help in Khartoum because I wouldn't even be allowed to go to the Nuba Mountains at this point.
Well, just in closing, UN Ambassador Susan Rice said that, you know, of course she was in charge of Africa in the Clinton administration. Yeah. She basically was saying that hardliners on both sides, they've captured the situation, both in terms of the hardliners in Khartoum and the hardliners in Juba. Do you think that's the dynamic?
Well, for now, but I do know that the people that I know in Khartoum are very, very distressed over the various moves that the northern government has made. I mean, they're distressed not only for the south and for Darfur and for the Nuba Mountains and what seems to be a never-ending series of conflicts, but really concerned. I'm talking about liberals and progressives. They're very concerned about their own state with this, by state I mean status, with this government that's talking so tough, because they're not only talking tough towards these marginal areas, but they're talking tough towards their own population living there in the capital and in other areas of northern Sudan, this flexing their muscles about the particular way that they're going to be enforcing Sharia, religious Islamic law.
Sure. And this is a leader who's been indicted by the International Criminal Court.
Exactly.
So, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks for talking to me, and good luck with any other interviews on this subject. I'm glad you're covering it.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Sandra Hale, a UCLA anthropologist. She's been studying, living, and doing field work in Sudan for over 50 years. She's the author of Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide, and her latest essay is available at the Journal of Middle East Studies, titled And Then There Were Two, What is Sudan Now? And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about what the real issues are in the so-called war on women.
Raise your flag with the guiding star and sing a song of freedom with joy. For peace, liberty, and justice shall forevermore reign. So Lord bless our Sudan. So Lord bless our Sudan.
We make a bed and raise our children. Then we leave a flat for being a fat old mother hen. We tell her home is the only place she should be. Then we complain that she's too unworthy to be our friend.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Heidi Hartman, who is the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the needs for women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartman is also a research professor at the George Washington University. Her areas of expertise are women and the economy, workforce participation, employment, pay equity, retirement security, and she lectures widely on women, economics, and public policy, frequently testifying before the U.S. Congress. She is Vice President of the National Council of Women's Organizations and co-editor of the Journal of Women, Politics, and Policy, and a co-author of Still a Man's Labor Market, The Long-Term Earning Gap, Unnecessary Losses, Costs to Americans for the Lack of Family and Medical Leave, and Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Heidi Hartman.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
And clearly we have a lot of hyperbole in the press now following Hillary Rosen's remarks about Ann Romney not working a day in her life. That's created a firestorm. There's this general context of a so-called war on women And in the case of the Hillary Rosen flap, it seemed to me that the issue really is, and of course she was, the rest of her quote wasn't included, but the real issue is not so much about working women versus stay-at-home mums. It's about what women get paid when they actually work, and most of them have to work.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, over the lifetime, you know, 95% of women work at some point, and usually for a good number of years. So the women that are in Ann Romney's position where they've been able to not work at all, there are very, very few. And I think Hillary Rosen's comment was really a comment about Ann Romney's class. It wasn't about gender at all. It was about class. And I think, you know, it got completely misinterpreted as, oh, she's against moms staying home to raise their children. You know, I think that was unfortunate, but perhaps predictable. And you're absolutely right. The wage gap is kind of stuck. It's been hovering around 3/4. 75% is what women make of what men earn for the last 10, 15 years. And there hasn't been much improvement. So, you know, I think many women are reasonably quite frustrated. They've done everything they can do. You know, they've gotten as much education. Many have gone to college more than men. They've been able to enter the occupations where a college degree or a professional degree matters, law, medicine. But they haven't been able to get as much into things like police, fire, construction, craft, trades. Those are jobs that pay well for people who don't necessarily have college education. And women have really not gotten their fair share of those jobs. So there's still an awful lot of sex typing in the labor market. And unfortunately, the jobs that women do disproportionately, let's say home health care aide, secretary, those just don't pay as well as similar jobs that men do that you know, have a similar level of skill or responsibility effort. The men's jobs pay more.
Well, at the risk of feeding the scandal machine and beating a dead story, Ann Romney did at a private fundraiser, which apparently an NBC producer overheard, she sort of somewhat showed that she was feigning aggrievement from Hillary Rosen's comments. She told the wealthy donors that Hillary Rosen's comments were my early birthday present for someone to be critical at me as a mother, and that was really a defining moment, and I loved it. So, not exactly an injured party.
Well, that's funny. I hadn't seen that yet. Well, I think, you know, the Republicans are looking for anything they can to get them off the hook as being, so they won't be perceived as having a war on women. And this definitely helps them. I'm afraid it's one of those comments like, you know, Hillary Clinton's, I don't just stay home and bake cookies, that, you know, will live on for quite some time and, you know, have some potential impact. Hard to know how much on how anyone would vote, but it certainly gives the Republicans a chance to regroup. They were really suffering, I think, under the contraceptive issues that were raised by the president's health care plan. You know, the HHS issued rules saying, yes, if you're an employer, you're going to have to cover contraceptives for free. You're not going to be able to charge people a copay. You're going to have to cover it. First of all, you're going to have to cover it. And second of all, you're not going to be able to charge a copay. So that is what caused the firestorm in the first place and caused the label, you know, war on women to kind of stick. That label had been being used by NOW, National Organization for Women, for the last 2, 3, 4 years. And, you know, nobody was using it until all of a sudden it got attached to that.
Well, but it seems to me, and perhaps we're just in the political silly season, it's probably going to get worse. And also, I think, as a culture, it's difficult to know the truth is a moving target. He who manages and manipulates and spins the truth wins the argument. People choose their own truth in many ways. Data doesn't matter, I think, particularly when it comes to conservatives. But you just mentioned a little while ago, Heidi Hartman, that 90% of women work. They have to work.
95% over the lifetime, and in any 1 year, about 60% of all women, this is everybody 16 and up. A lot of those young people are in college, and of course the older people are retired, so yeah.
So what are we? Why are we talking about this 5% atavistic vision of Ozzie and Harriet's world from black and white television in the 50s?
Well, it's always appealing to go back. I think that's been one of the themes of the feminist criticism of the Republican agenda. They want to, especially on contraception, they wanted to take us back not just to the 1950s, but, you know, the Middle Ages. I mean, you know, the rhetoric's been flying around. So I think nostalgia is always appealing. Though, you know, let's bear in mind that a great many women, perhaps about half, take some time off during the child-rearing years. I think something like half of women take at least a year off, and something like a quarter of women take several years off during the period when their children are young. But the majority experience, the overwhelmingly majority experience for mothers in this country is working. Their children are, you know, going to grow to adulthood, and they've only taken a few years off at most. So I think the Democrats can recover, you know, their turf by emphasizing how much they do for working women, how much they are the party of working women, how they're trying to get working women equal wages. I think the Republicans really have very little to say about that.
Well, one Republican governor who's somewhat in the midst of a firestorm, he's being recalled, Scott Walker, in the midst of this heated political environment, in a somewhat stealthy way, he reversed a Wisconsin law allowing equal pay. And, I mean, that in itself is a pretty extraordinary thing, isn't it? I mean, that is really literally and figuratively turning back the clock.
Definitely. We've had a federal Equal Pay Act since 1963, and really people became aware of an equal pay like about the beginning of the 20th century. There were articles written about it in the economics journals in England and the United States, and it really became a movement during World War II when so many women had to take over men's jobs, and it was legal to pay them less for the jobs the men had been doing. And so that required got going a lot of agitation in this country and others, and by 1963, they finally succeeded in getting a bill passed. Yeah, so anyone who wants to turn the clock back is, I mean, when it comes to appealing to voters, I think they're out of their mind trying to do stuff like that.
Well, I suppose we'll see what happens with this recall, but I imagine it's motivated a lot of women to vote against Governor Walker in the recall petition.
Yes, I think so. And I do recall also during the occupation of the state capitol building, there were a lot of women, very prominent nurses and other union employees especially, but, you know, very, very supportive of that effort to keep the collective bargaining rights in that state. So I think women are, in general, more favorable towards helping each other out. They're usually in favor of assisting the poor, providing federal subsidies for childcare, for job training, for education. They're very much community oriented, and that is you know, much more a Democratic agenda. And so that it kind of tends to explain why more registered Democrats are female than among registered Republicans. More Democratic voters in primaries are female. And right now, of course, the polls are showing a big gender gap in President Obama's favor.
Against Mitt Romney.
Yes.
Whose wife, Ann, thought she had a winning argument there for a while. But, of course, she succeeded in reversing herself in private. But let me again remind the audience, I'm speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who's the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the needs for women-centered, policy-oriented research. And she's also a research professor at the George Washington University. I have a daughter in medical school, and most of her class are women. And I believe that's also true with entrance in law schools in this country. So how are they doing in terms of equal pay? Is that... And contrast that with the rest of the working community.
Well, first of all, congratulations. And when you have children that, you know, get advanced degrees, that's good because they're much more likely to earn, you know, living wages, more than living wages, and not experience unemployment and so forth. So it's a good path for people to get on a secure future. In general, women have done a much better job in getting into those kinds of professions where they can get credentials from universities. And they are usually, and getting into that profession raises women's salary, but it doesn't necessarily raise it up to what the men are getting in that profession. It may be that they choose different specialties and the men choose higher earning specialties. It may be that the men get the partnerships at the bigger law firms. But medicine is actually doing a little bit better than law. And part of the reason for that seems to be that it's more able to adjust hours for child rearing and childbirth. So there are quite a few doctors who work part-time during the childbearing years, and they're able to do that. A lot of them are on salary. The women seem to prefer to be in the salaried situation rather than their own practices. We know whether that's discrimination in getting credit or whatever, who knows. So it's not necessarily all choice. It can be barriers that are that they perceive. But so women do earn less in professions than men in general, but by entering a profession, women earn so much more than if they don't go to college or don't get that advanced degree. So it's a big advantage to women to get those degrees. One of the worst industries for women is finance. Securities, investments, huge gender gap there. Some of the best are where we are in the public sector and have collective bargaining. So teaching, police. Police has virtually equal wages now between women and men, and sheriffs as well, as does public school teaching. So, you know, there are areas where you can get equal pay, but of course, elementary school teachers not as high paid as a doctor or a lawyer. So many women are going to go in to law and medicine who have the skills. They won't necessarily get equal pay, but they will get very high pay for women, you know, because women's pay on average is so much lower.
So what's the reason for that? Is that a convenient disparity for employers in the sense that, you know, I think employers probably, if they have a choice between paying more and paying less, they'd prefer to pay less? Or is this a holdover of, you know, the kind of Jurassic patriarchy?
Well, that could be both, right? I mean, that is, it could be the holdover from patriarchy, and it could be of interest to employers because they can pay less. I think a typical example is, you know, if only men could become secretaries, there for some reason there were no female secretaries, and we still have secretaries, believe it or not, although they seem to be disappearing from most of our lives, it's still one of the largest occupations for women in the United States. What would they have to pay men to find enough men with enough skills to be secretaries, you know? Language skills, grammatical skills, typing skills, etc., filing, organizational skills, and probably they'd have to pay them more than what they're paying secretaries now, because men with those skills, you know, have more higher-paying options that they can go into than women with those skills have. So that's the comparable worth problem that, because secretary is a female job, they can get away with paying less for it. Well, that is, I believe, profitable to business. It's like they're getting a free ride on women, on women's backs. So I do think that there is a reason to keep women's wages low, just as there's a reason to keep the wages of African Americans or Hispanics low. You can exploit people because they don't have other options. A lot of the jobs aren't unionized, so they don't have that protection. So, it's definitely profitable for businesses to pay people less than they're worth. And I'm sure they're making money on it. That doesn't mean that you can't change it. You know, you can change it through law, enforcement of law, political organization, collective bargaining. We've made changes. Wage gap used to be 60 cents on the dollar for women. Now it's all the way up to 77 cents on the dollar. So we have made progress, but, you know, we still have a bit more way to go there.
Well, how is it translating politically, though? We started out, Heidi Hartman, talking about the so-called war on women, which Fox News is in a lather about, saying it's all phony, which I suspect means that it's bothering Republican strategists. But it is fairly real, at least if you followed the primaries. There's some extraordinary things were said, particularly by Rick Santorum.
Rick Santorum has been saying that single mothers are the dragging down our economy and, you know, all kinds of stuff that we haven't heard in quite some time.
So where do you think it stands as a political issue? Is it going to be visiting us throughout this? I mean, they say that Romney has a women problem. I mean, the president, on the other hand, he one of the first things he did was a Lilly Ledbetter Act. I mentioned that Governor Scott Walker overturned an equal pay law in Wisconsin. Just give us a sense of where this stands as an election year political issue.
Well, I think it'll be pretty high on the agenda. You know, every right around the time of the election, both parties suddenly realize, oops, women vote. We better look like we're doing something for women. So there's always that tendency in any election year. But obviously, this year, it's elevated even more. And I think there were two reasons for that. One was the contraceptive debate about the health care and the fact that the Republican candidates, you know, were happy to say they want to get rid of that. They don't want that. And that does definitely rile women. They are very upset about that. By the way, it upsets many men, too. Men are interested in birth control. Men are supportive of abortion, for example, sometimes even more than women in surveys. So, you know, these are not just women's issues. And even equal pay is supported as almost as much by men as about women. I remember in one focus group, it was reported to me that a man said, you know, my wife is just as tired as I am at the end of the day. Why doesn't she make the same money I do? And so this equal pay is very much a family issue for men and women as well. So, you know, what's billed as women's issues is really of interest to men as well. But I, you know, as a think tank, as running ahead of a think tank on women, I certainly hope it remains a focus the whole election season long. It will be, I think, the first time in a long time that women's issues really would be a focus of a campaign. From that point of view, it might be very interesting to see what the platform committees do at the annual conventions. Are they going to be trying to strengthen their party platforms on women's issues? For example, the Equal Rights Amendment, passage of that, I believe the Democrats took it out a few years ago. It hasn't been in the Republican Party platform for quite some time. So there are quite a few issues where, you know, both parties could improve how they're, what they're doing for women, what they're presenting they want to do for women, and appealing to women voters, speaking more to women's organizations out on the campaign trail. They, you know, both of them have substantial areas for improvement.
Well, do you think that given that the Democrats are sort of the mommy party, a majority of 60% of women vote for Democrat, and conversely, the Republicans are the daddy party, 60% of American men vote for Republican, is there any way, we mentioned Romney's a deficit with women and how he might address that, but how do you think the Democrats could find a way to appeal to Republican men on the issue of women? You mentioned earlier these men must recognize that their wives are working too and that they're just exhausted at the end of the day, and maybe they need a pay raise to have a level playing field with men.
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly appeals to some men. I think what the parties usually do is talk about things they perceive as of potentially greater interest to men. Energy policy, military policy, you know, it's all on the margins. You don't necessarily have to convince Republicans or Democrats to do anything different. You have to go after those independent voters, or a group that didn't go for Obama was older voters. He could get more votes there. The Republicans could strengthen their stronghold in older voters. They have a lot of options to choose among where they want to try to appeal to swing over some voters. I think since there hasn't been an attack on the American homeland, the security voters that George Bush might have gotten might be less inclined to go Republican. And also, of course, Obama has a pretty good record there with finally assassinating Osama bin Laden. So, you know, it's interesting to me to see how the Democrats will appeal to men more. I think jobs is on everybody's mind, and job creation is very important for men and women. I mean, in the recent months, we've seen some good job growth for both, but before that, we saw women losing a lot of jobs in state and local government. How to get those jobs back? Well, transfer some money from the federal government to the state and local governments. Obama and the Democrats wanted to do that. The Republicans didn't. So the Republicans are weak, I think, on job creation for women, for sure. And job creation for everybody is just difficult. If an economist friend of mine likes to say, if politicians knew how to create good jobs, they'd do it all the time. They would never stop doing it. But we do know that economic stimulus does work, and that spending more federal money does create more jobs. So those are some options, but those options don't seem to be going through Congress. But it's certainly something Democrats can campaign on. If I were them, I would be campaigning very strongly on Social Security and Medicare. I would be saying I will not cut Social Security, and we have to control health care costs, and Medicare will benefit from that general control of health care costs, but not to be looking to cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, or cut Social Security. You could get a lot of older voters back on the Democratic side if the Democrats emphasize that they would not cut, you know, read my lips, I will not cut Social Security benefits. Unfortunately, we haven't heard that kind of promise from President Obama.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Heidi Hartmann.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Heidi Hartmann, who is the president of the Washington-based Institute for Women's Policy Research, a scientific research organization that she founded in 1987 to meet the need for women-centered, policy-oriented research. Dr. Hartmann is also a research professor at the George Washington University, and she is the vice chair of the National Council of Women's Organization and co-editor of the journal of Women, Politics, and Policy, and the author of Equal Pay for Working Families and Survival at the Bottom. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll get answers to the mystery still surrounding the 60-minute story that killed Dan Rather's career and helped re-elect George W. Bush. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joe Hagan, a contributing editor at New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal. He began at New York Magazine in 2006 after working as a staff reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where he was part of the team that covered the Valerie Plame CIA leak case. He spent the preceding years as a columnist for The New York Observer, working under legendary editor Peter Kaplan and breaking a series of stories on Dan Rather travails at CBS News. He has an article at the Texas Monthly, Dan Rather Was Right About George W. Bush. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Hagan.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Let me just start by saying that the title of the story is Truth or Consequences.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there's some people have been reporting it as Dan Rather Was Right About George Bush, but that's not exactly what I say in the story.
Okay, well, it's what happens when you print out your story from the Texas Monthly.
Go ahead.
Well, then answer that question then. Was Dan Rather right?
Well, he was right about some things. Now, his report in 2004, as you'll recall, came during a presidential election between Senator John Kerry and George Bush, and one of the main sort of political debates at the time was who had the credibility to continue the wage in command to the Iraq War, which was going very badly at the time. And so this began to revolve around whether, you know, Kerry's service in Vietnam versus George W. Bush's, what was he doing during Vietnam, and did he get preferential treatment to get into the National Guard? Was he dodging the draft? And then did he bail out of his service and go AWOL? These were the questions. Dan Rather reported two things. He had a man on who claimed to have gotten Bush in to the Guard in 1968 as a favor to the Bush family. And then he also had a second part to his report with these documents that said that, you know, Bush's commanding officers had come under some pressure to sugarcoat his record because he did not actually fulfill his duties. So this was the controversial part of the report. What I can say is that did Bush get some preferential treatment to get into the Guard in 68? I show in my story, I get really deep into this, that there was no way he could have gotten into the Guard when he did and how he did without some kind of influence. But that's the way it worked. In the next National Guard in Texas, it was a corrupt, good old boy system, and you had to, get a particular man to sign off on it. And this man was very political and was, you know, treated it as a bottleneck. Then the next second part of the question becomes: why did he stop flying his airplane prematurely? He was an Air Force, an Air National Guard pilot, and did he disappear for a year? Well, these can't be answered definitively. I would say that the memos that CBS used are certainly dubious. I would not have trusted them. There's a lot of big problems with them, and if you put a gun to my head, I'd say they're fake. They can't be proved beyond the shadow of a doubt because they are Xerox copies. You know, forensics experts like to take ink samples and be able to say, I can tell you within a beyond the shadow of a doubt, this is from a certain era. But what we can know is that there's these serious gaps in Bush's record that have never been explained, that he has never explained. And there's pretty strong circumstantial evidence. There are two pieces of evidence that suggest that Bush stopped flying his airplane because he could no longer land it, that he began to have trouble flying it, that he was becoming unfocused as a pilot, and that his commanders may have decided that he was no longer fit to fly and allowed him to, you know, transfer and go into a different status.
But it remains, I suppose, and somewhat ironically so, that where George Bush's perhaps his biggest vulnerability at that time, in a race that he only won by 2 points in the pivotal state of Ohio against John Kerry, was that John Kerry was a war hero. There were doubts about George W. Bush's Vietnam War record and the Champagne Squadron that you mentioned, and the favorite son treatment, and all the lost year, etc. At the end of the day, somehow Karl Rove took away John Kerry's being a hero, and right. Dan Rather and however this thing worked out, which is what the heart of your story is, managed to get rid of Bush's greatest vulnerability.
Well, that's true, and here's why I wrote the story and why I think it's interesting. First of all, my whole thesis in the story is like that, you know, and it's true that Dan Rather's downfall was the cork in the story. You know, you could never really return to the story again. They, as I put it in the story, they made Dan Rather's reputation became the tombstone of this story. But the story, I wanted to just sort of put aside the controversy of CBS and those memos and say, well, what do we know that's true? What is the real story about what happened to Bush, and how did this story come to be? And I tell the whole backstory of it, and it's a very deep and wild tale. I mean, the more I got into it, the weirder and more interesting it became, which is why I wrote the story. And why I think it's important is because, you know, Bush's presidential library is going to be opening next year. And this part of his biography is very, I think, very important to understanding him as a president and his political persona. You'll recall that in 2003, he landed in a jet airplane on the aircraft carrier under the banner Mission Accomplished. And this was seen as a great political mistake and kind of a terrible irony because the war sort of descended into a bloody quagmire after that. But obviously, this was a part of his political image, that he was this stud pilot. And so this story about what actually happened to him during those years, and whether he was actually somebody who was avoiding combat and who actually couldn't fly his plane, you know, these are questions that are worth asking because they strike at amazingly profound ironies.
But can't you say, though, Joe Hagan, again, contributing editor at New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal, and the author of an article at the Texas Monthly, again, what's the correct title?
Truth or Consequences.
Truth or Consequences. The long and the short of it is that the lost year is, I think, by definition, a lost year because you can't get any information about it. I mean, isn't...
Here's what we can know, and I went as deep as you can get into this without going crazy, which is there are documents. You can only go by documents and with eyewitnesses to tell you what happened 30-odd years ago, 40 years ago. There's a document in his record that, by his commanding officer, they allowed him to transfer away from his home base for a year to go work on a Senate campaign that his dad had set him up in. He stopped flying. He lost his flight status by failing to take a flight physical, which under normal circumstances would have sparked an investigation, and they would have had to look into why did this pilot throw away his status as a pilot. Well, that never happened. And there were no paper records showing that when he went away to another state, Alabama in this case, to work on this campaign, that he filed for a transfer and was supposed to be continuing his duty there for that full year. Well, there were no paper there's no paper trail showing he did any duty while he was away for that year. There are no credible eyewitnesses who can say, I saw him serving. Nobody ever saw him serve. There are no papers that show him serving. So that was the basis of the investigation into the lost year. What was he doing during this year? And what I found is, you know, in 2004, the Bush White House did put out these computerized pay records they suddenly dug up that showed that he had supposedly served some dates in Alabama where he was, you know, during this lost year. However, there's problems with those dates, and that's what I circled around. So what you end up coming down to, the bottom line here is, there is no credible explanation for all the conflicting data about what he was doing. Nobody ever saw him. There were rewards put out. If you ever saw George Bush serving in Alabama in 1972, we'll give you $50,000. Okay, nobody collected that money. There was another reward for $10,000 by the author of Doonesbury, the cartoon, Gary Trudeau, not collected. And these dates, as I said, that he supposedly was paid for service in Alabama, he was actually living in Houston at the time. So that makes no sense whatsoever. So there's like these conflicting things. There's a mystery that remains there. And I spoke with an ex-girlfriend of his who said she never saw him in Alabama again. You know, she would have known had he been in Alabama serving during these dates because, you know, she was dating him. So, you know, there's problems here and there's something not right and it remains something of a mystery there, but or a black hole. But the fact is that post all of this, I will say that some very credible, high-up former Air Force commanders and generals have looked at his record and say, well, based on what he, you know, his records, he should not have, you know, he did not fulfill his duty. You know, that there was not the way he served did not qualify as fulfillment. But his officers down at the time, you know, this was a very sort of like a good old boy, kind of highly corrupt and politicized National Guard in Texas in the late 60s and early 70s. You know, they looked the other way. Now, this is like a garden variety story for sons of wealth at this time. This is not like a big controversy. It only becomes a controversy 30 years later, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, they just did the paperwork the way they had to do it to make it okay for him. And this was not like illegal or nefarious. It just was what it was. Now, when you put it into a political lens and you're talking about the President of the United States and a man who starts a major war in the Middle East, well, it becomes has high political metaphorical value. And that's what my story delves into in a really kind of a deeper way than I think has been done before.
So, Joe Hagan, let's get into the 60 Minutes side of it and how they a lot of people felt that it was a sort of gray operation in terms of almost a sting in a way that that these Xerox documents didn't have the right fonts for the time, and the right-wing blogosphere immediately seemed to seize upon it. 60 Minutes went just before they went to air. They showed the memos to the White House, and Dan Bartlett at the White House basically didn't say that they were no good, and that has led a lot of people to assume that was a kind of a setup, that Bartlett was baiting the trap for them, that this was, you know, yet another example of the genius of the nefarious Karl Rove. So walk us through that.
Well, a lot of people came to believe that, including, you know, a lot of people in the CBS universe believed that. But a lot of things were believed about this story. One of the things that happened with the Bush National Guard story is over the, 15 years that it was a political item, starting when he was governor in Texas, it began to kind of collect a lot of conspiracy theories around it. It became very muddied by opportunists and cranks who kind of who wanted to be involved and prove something about that story, including the man who gave those documents to CBS, who was a man who had a very sort of dubious history with this story. He had been claiming since the late 90s that he witnessed Bush aides scrubbing, or throwing away pieces of Bush's record to clean it up, so to speak. And he had become kind of like enmeshed in this story and was the man who, you know, 6 years after he makes that claim, gives them to CBS.
This is now, Bill Burkett, the West Texas rancher who claims that he got these documents at a cattle show in Houston.
Right. Well, that's an explanation he came up with after he told lots of other explanations.
Right. Well,
and
that's pretty
some
bizarre.
People thought he had been duped. You know, other people thought he was the duper. And, you know, again, that is a dead-end trail because nobody can get, you know, Burkett will never talk about, you know, he claims all he knows is what he knows, that he had, you know, given these by some shady characters.
In terms of muddying the water, Dan Rather muddied the water and paid the ultimate price, this fellow Hatfield released a book through St. Martin's Press, and then it was revealed that he himself had served 5 years in prison for hiring a hitman to kill a former colleague, and he later committed suicide. So, again, George W. Bush is rescued by those who who were trying to...
Well, a lot of people aren't going to want to hear this, but, you know, I'm an investigative reporter by trade, and a lot of what I'm paid to do is to, investigate these theories and then either follow them or disprove them.
Well, we have to wrap it up.
Just give you the sad news is that, you know, it was like a lot of kind of very feverish Democrats who drove a lot of the conspiracies around this and helped Bush by creating all of these wacky theories that ended up that Dan Rather became a victim of. Now, that's his fault.
Right.
But he got enmeshed in these conspiracy theories when the truth was already out there. I mean,
the truth was bad enough in itself.
It was just already there.
Yeah,
but Walter Robinson of the Boston Globe had done a massive investigation on this.
Well, thank you for joining us, Joe Hagan. I'm sorry we ran out of time. Again, Joe Hagan, contributing editor at the New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Men's Journal, and he is the author of this article currently at the Texas Monthly. Truth and Consequences. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.